Welcome to Gluck Radio. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, executive life coach and master problem solver. Today we're joined by stripper and writer Antonia Crane. Crane wrote about her tumultuous life both inside and outside the sex industry in her latest memoir, Spent. But this is not just an expose on the world of stripping, but a touching personal tale of loneliness, struggle, and finding community. From unionizing a strip club to getting arrested, from drug addiction to nursing a dying mother, Crane can clear up a lot of our misconceptions and teach us a lot about resilience.
What was her childhood like? And how did that inform her later life as a sex worker? How did a woman who studied feminism in college by day bare her body to lecherous men by night? We'll also be talking about the concept of strippers being rescued by men and whether the professional life bleeds into the personal life when it comes to stripping.
Antonia, welcome.
Go for it.
Okay. You have a great voice, by the way. I want you to know
you have
a voice for radio.
You give good radio.
You give good radio. Add that to your list.
It's my lesbian phone sex voice.
Okay. Hey, you know, we need more of that. So let me ask you the question. Why did you choose to actually write your memoir? What was the motivation behind it?
Well, I was in grad school writing fiction, and it was so autobiographical. And while I was in grad school, my mother died, and I was doing sex work. And so those two narratives, I kept braiding those narratives, and I couldn't escape it. I couldn't escape those two narratives. And so I started writing nonfiction, and my mentor said, you know, you should just go with this. This is what's true right now. And that's how writing happens. You know, there are things that are percolating in your brain, and you have to just let them out. And so that's what happened.
I was just going to ask you how the two narratives interweave.
Have you read the book?
Absolutely.
Okay, so
very candid and very brave, I have to say.
Oh, thank you. Well, I think that memory is tricky territory. And while my mother was dying, I was doing sex work. And there's something about being a visceral experience of being with bodies and being naked with other bodies. And grieving that really played with time and triggered a lot of memories of watching my mom's body decline and die, and being with her through that transition and being with her while she died. Being with men in rooms, hotels, I called it the lab, where I was doing sensual massage. It triggered a lot of memories, and really death and sex were very much intertwined in that experience. Because I believe that when there's a lot of rhetoric about being present, like the whole Eckhart Tolle, like that we're present in this time and in this moment. And I feel like we're always haunted. I feel like there's no present that's not haunted with the past. And I was sort of carrying my dead into the present.
And to me, you know, first of all, I love the way you process. It's kind of very, very refreshing. But let me ask you this question. To me, what it sounds like is that the warmth of life or the connection, because you seem to be very good at making connections and very good at bringing people into your own personal community, was a way of soothing and comforting yourself in light of your mom's death. Does that sound close to true?
Absolutely. It's totally satisfying I got to kind of mother people and mother clients, and it was very comforting to me. It's very comforting to feel desired and wanted.
But don't you think there's some conflict in your book? That's what was fascinating. I think most interesting people are conflicted anyway. And you talk about feeling dehumanized and degraded, desperate for money, really servicing men that you find repulsive. And then at the same time, you refer to it as validating your sexuality, as this being your tribe and so forth. So I thought that was one of the interesting themes in your book.
Thank you. Yeah, it's not black and white. You know, there's a lot of, this comes up a lot, and I think it's a really important thing to think about, because it's, I could have written a memoir that was totally defensive and only pro-sex work. And there's a lot of truth to feeling empowered, and I talk about that stuff a lot, but it is also very, there is a lot of conflict.
Two things. I always talk to my clients about the worst thing you could have is cognitive dissonance, which basically means believing something and acting against that belief, and it's the source of all anxiety. Now, there's a lot about sex work which you obviously enjoy very, very much, and I completely understand it. But why choose your clients? Why would you have to work with someone you don't want to work with?
Because that's what work is. The definition of work is working with people that we don't want to work with. You show up and go to work every day and talk to people you don't really want to talk to and deal with people and learn how to handle and manage people.
It's probably why I'm in my own business. I don't work with anyone I don't want to work with.
But contrast that with the great courtesans of the Renaissance and the Belle Epoque. I mean, those women were distinguished from prostitutes because they could choose their clients. And that was the big distinction there.
Yeah, we're talking about different levels of class.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Betsy, let me ask you this question. Meaning, the fact is, what I'm hearing from her is that it's work. And sometimes it's enjoyable work, sometimes it's not. But at the end of the day, pushing through something she doesn't like also added a degree of strength, even though it had some pain associated, unless I'm misreading you.
No, I think that's a good assessment.
So why wouldn't the pain that she's saying, listen, this is just part of life, why wouldn't that be beneficial? Because one of the big problems that kids have today is that they don't know how to deal with pain.
Pain is always beneficial. Sometimes. I think it's always beneficial.
Well, it's not, meaning if you put a nail in your shoe and it doesn't need to be there, it's not really beneficial.
Don't step on nails. That's the lesson learned.
I don't understand why you would seek out pain. I mean, you say in your childhood that you had a craving for danger to yourself. And I don't know where that stemmed from. Of course, strength comes from suffering. We all know that. But to seek it out when life serves you so much anyway, I wonder why you have this special desire to almost injure yourself, especially with the bulimia, the meth addiction, and so forth.
Betsy, your guess is as good as mine.
You know what? I'm going to say two things. I'm going to say, obviously, there's a wiring. That's kind of just the way you're wired.
The way you're wired. You know, you're born an addict. And then there's a lot of debate about, are we born addicts? Are we born gay? Are we born addicts? Are we born, you know, I think so. I think probably I was, you know, it's part of the addictive personality, seeking them an edge and seeking darkness. I know that it's really personal to me that, and this isn't true for everybody. It's true for me. But when I'm feeling something really deeply, and I think that everything in this culture points us to in a direction to not feel and to just buy things. And, you know, that's a challenge of this generation. To think and feel deeply, I think, is the biggest challenge that our youth faces today.
Yeah, no, but let me ask this, because I completely get, you know, the experiential sexual, I love the way you use the word the lab. I understand that, but at the end of the day, you had control. With meth, there is no control. It controlled you. Why would you, and therefore it limits your experience, because if you don't control something, you're not experiencing it, you're being taken over by it.
I'm not sure what the question is.
Yeah, me neither. No, I said the question is why the meth? How did you get into the meth, and how the hell did you get out of it?
Oof, yeah. I tried meth in my early 20s when I was experimenting with drugs, and it delivered. It was dark. It was exciting. It was euphoric. I was a girl with some eating disorder, you know, baggage, and it absolutely delivered. It sent me out of my skin. It made me feel creative and smart, although it wasn't. You know, I was a really bad tweaker. I couldn't handle my life and drugs at the same time. So, you know, some people can manage, and
so
I absolutely.
How did you leave that web?
Well, in my book, I did the spin cycle of, you know, wash, rinse, repeat, you know, try to get off it for a couple of days, take pills to come down, try to get clean. And I found that I couldn't. And so one of the times I tried to quit, I was crashing really hard off of it. And I wanted to feel something other than what I was feeling. And I took a knife to my wrist and I ended up on a 72-hour hold, which I heard is all the rage again. I heard 72-hour holds are back in fashion.
And cupcakes too.
And cupcakes too, yeah. So I got, that's how I got clean. I had no interest in, this is where I'm going to tell on myself. I had no interest really in getting clean or staying clean. I just wanted to feel differently. And that's when I my feet just walked into AA and I just stayed. And I got clean and I stayed clean and I found people that I could relate to.
Hey, listen, it worked for you and that's what counts. Now you mentioned you knew you were bisexual at a very young age. What it sounds to me is that you're not bisexual, you're trisexual. You will try anything that actually connects to you.
Yeah, I'm not bi-curious, I'm just curious.
Yeah, that's it. Okay. In it, do you feel? Tell me the difference how you feel with a man than you feel with a woman.
What is it? Well, how do you feel different with a man and with a woman?
Well, I'm a lesbian.
I assumed that.
Trust me, it's true. I just find women ridiculously beautiful and attractive and intelligent, and so I couldn't tell you about the guy thing. But I think the whole idea of intimacy is, you know, for me, it always has to be more than physical. It has to be emotional, curious, and. You know, and almost like a, you know, a journey where you don't know where it's going to end up.
Yeah, it's exciting and adventurous, right?
Yeah.
But can I go back? This is terrible. I don't want to trench into psychological territory. But
excuse Betsy, go for it.
But let's do it, okay? So here's your childhood. Your mother was abused, right?
Yeah.
And then your father deserted your mother, correct? And then. You've got some issues there. A father who you're afraid of, a mother who gave you some maybe poor modeling, and it would seem to me, apart from any genetic propensity, make you bisexual, wouldn't it? I mean, you would seek in women the mother you never had. In men, there would be a search for the lost father, et cetera.
Oh, sure. I mean, it's pretty textbook. I mean,
I know.
When I was raised, no, that's okay.
It's simplistic, I know, but I'm just.
Well, you know, it goes back, Beth, to nature and nurture.
Well, okay. And bad boundaries. You know, like in the 70s, our parents befriended us. And I think that it's, you know, really sketchy boundaries happened. And then my father was very absent. And, you know, that's very intriguing. It's, I haven't met a woman. If there's one thing that I think porn industry and adult industry women have in common, it's an absent parent, if anything.
That's interesting.
It's an absent, neglectful parent.
So what you're saying is that it's not necessarily a choice. It is a reaction to some deep level of pain that has existed because of early childhood or lack of childhood nurturing.
I wouldn't say that it's not a choice. For me, it is a choice because I wasn't sold into sex slavery. I wasn't involved in a prostitution ring. I never had a pimp. It was very much a choice, but it was a choice that all guns were firing in that direction, I think, for me. And I think that choice, nothing made more sense.
So talk to us about the sex industry. Tell us what you found enjoyable and what you like, what you resonate with, and tell us what you, in fact, found dangerous or, you know, appalling.
Oh, wow. That's a huge question.
I know. And I know that you have the answer. See, that I trust you.
Experience. I do have experience. Well, you know, when there's the before and after getting clean. So when I was on drugs and using, I was a terrible stripper. I was, you know, I was horribly awkward. I did everything wrong. I didn't know how to talk to men. I would cry.
Yeah, crying is sexy.
It's a disaster. Yeah. Who doesn't love a crying stripper?
Exactly. Yeah. probably a crying client.
No, the crying clients, I really like crying clients now. But before, I was the crying stripper, you know, dancing to sad music. And it was, you know, I was on speed and I was supporting my I had a habit to support and a girlfriend at home, and I needed to contribute. And I was at a women's college, and I was, this is funny, I was studying post-structural feminist theory, and a really exciting time in San Francisco. It was a time of performance art and a time of guerrilla feminism. People like Karen Finley and Diamanda Galas and Kathy Acker were hitting the radar. And, you know, we were all about performing our sexuality and taking it back. And I thought, hey, you know, I'm going to take down the patriarchy one lap dance at a time.
Yeah, but, you know, all of those women you mentioned, especially Kathy Acker, had the most tragic love life. I mean, these were women who were discarded by men and quite angry, weren't they?
They were angry women, absolutely.
But that doesn't sound like you. You do not sound angry at all.
Now I'm not, but I think back then I may have been.
Oh, so continuing the story. So tell me what happened after you got clean.
Okay, so yeah,
I'm sorry.
I was a lesbian. No, it's fine. I was a lesbian, and I was, you know, studying post-structural feminist theory, and I was stalking Kathy Acker, and I marched into the strip clubs and with an agenda and to make money. And I'm thinking I was just going to pull one over on the entire system. And maybe I did. We did unionize the strip club. However, what happened was the clients that I met just thought I was the most fascinating creature they had ever talked to. And they were extremely generous with me and were pretty sweet to me and were really kind to me. And I couldn't hate them. This is San Francisco when money was, you know, basically all the service industry was just, everyone had $100 bills falling out of their pockets. It was a different time. You know, it was the Clinton era. It was the beginning of the dot-com boom. And so stripping was, you know, performance art, and it was respected in that culture. And San Francisco has always enjoyed a subversive, celebrating a diverse and subversive culture.
You know, yeah, I know that. And I know it makes sense. It was the Clinton era. Was he a customer?
No, he was not. I wish he was.
All right. So obviously you were making money.
Yeah, but Monica Lewinsky came in. She's a lesbian, but I'm just kidding. But the drugs took over, like you said. Meth has a way of eclipsing everything, and so I that became my priority. That erased all my other priorities, and I eventually dropped out of school and just was doing a lot of drugs. But yeah, I was a terrible stripper. And then I got clean and went back to the Peep Show, and we unionized that club, and that's when it became, you know, I met my tribe of remarkably intelligent, exciting, interesting women who were, I don't know, they were educated, they were performers, they were artists, they were teachers, some of them had kids. And it was just kind of a clean, well-groomed, well-mannered environment. And that's when we unionized the Lusty Lady.
But then it deteriorated pretty quickly in your narrative. I mean, there are lots of negatives to sex work. What were they? I mean, there's some scenes of real depravity, I thought, and deep sleaze.
Yeah, the deep sleaze. I like that.
Yeah, it actually sounds like the title of a movie.
Sleaze should have been the title of my book.
Betsy, you should do deepsleaze.com and
believe me,
sell it for something.
I'm not a prude at all. I'm just, you know,
no, I love that.
There were scenes that were really hard to read.
You know, there's something attractive about deep sleeves.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that goes back to your attraction to danger and the dark side.
Sure.
Tell me about your religious beliefs. I'm curious about that. Your religious / spiritual.
Wow, that's a strange thing to bring up right now. On the cuff of deep sleeves.
I was going to ask you that or what you ate for breakfast. I decided to ask you that.
You know, like sexuality, I think I'm just curious, and I'm more curious all the time. You know, I didn't make a bird. I didn't make the ocean. I believe in science, and I also believe in God. I believe if there's one thing that I think is, if there's something that I believe in love. I think that is, if there's something worth a shit that's worth believing in, it's love. And I don't know what that is, but that seems to be something that I could put my money on that is worth a shit that's in the world when there's a ton of violence and cruelty and just unfathomable cruelty. That if there's something worth believing in, that thing is love.
And tell me about the love in your life.
Being of service teaches me about love. You know, I'm really active in AA, and I volunteer for organizations that I publish incarcerated teenage girls' creative writing, and I've worked with teenagers and young adults, teaching them writing. And to me, that it's something that helps people process their feelings and process their lives. And to me, it's been such a salvation, you know.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Helping young people get clean and sober and helping them better their lives and being of direct service to people when I'm asked to help, even when I don't have the resources to help anyway, is my spiritual belief. And that's the thing that saves me from, you know, my ego, and it saves me from being too attached to an outcome.
Actually, that's quite impressive.
I was going to ask you about your own love life and how you envision that unfolding. There's a story about Ian that's sketched in, I think, rather briefly. And I wondered how you perceive your own romantic life in the future.
In the future?
Or what you would desire, or how you would pursue it?
Betsy, that's such a great question. What do I want in my love life? I want all the boring stuff that everybody else wants.
Yeah.
I want a caring partner that's interesting to me and that's fun and sweet. And what's really important is to partner up with somebody who will not hold my past against me and who will find it interesting and intriguing and not hold it against me, and who can accept the sex work part of me, because that's been a huge issue.
I mean, would that continue? I mean, if you found the love of your life, let's say, and everything else clicked, would you give up sex work?
Well, you know, I tried that.
I think with Ian, is that right?
No, it was after the book. I had never given up sex work before. I was ready to give it up. You know, I've been ready to give it up 100 times, but it's like drugs. You just have to keep quitting. I did fall in love with someone who was uncomfortable with it, and we talked about me quitting, and I was ready to quit, and he wanted me to quit. And we had a beautiful life together for a short time, but that ended. He started drinking again, and I couldn't be in that environment anymore. But mostly it was that he could never accept my path. And
you know what? I want you to understand this and kind of put it down for the record. Everyone has a life, and the life is made up of chapters, and each chapter is a different part of history. And to hold something against someone for the different chapters in their life and the complexity of what they go through is just sheer ignorance. And I don't know any, I imagine that there are guys who would hold this against you, but baby, you are so too good for those guys.
Aw, See, if you're going to make me cry, then you need to be giving me a lap dance.
Well, that's why I asked you to come in person. But,
Steve Almond, one of my favorite professors and favorite people, said that, or he wrote that love is sustained attention ending in eventual mercy. And so that's what I'm after. That's my jam. And I think that that's what I gave my mother. And I think that, like we talked about earlier, like that I talked about earlier, in a culture that is so full of distractions and by messages, like to give someone sustained attention, ending in eventual mercy, that's like the biggest gift that we could give each other. And that comes back to like the thing that I think is worth believing in is love.
Yeah, attention is the food of love. It's a wonderful quote.
Who said that? That's a great.
Betsy did.
Andre Gide.
Deep sleaze, and then this. You know, she's becoming my.
You never know what comes out of her mouth. It's always intelligent, but you never know what's going to be said. So let me give you my definition of in love, because there's love and in love, which is kind of like insane. It's to me, it's
scientifically it is.
Yeah. So I see love as a unexplainable emotional connection to another person's well-being, and you just feel connected. You want them to do well, and you are emotionally a part of their roller coaster.
Yeah.
For the good or for the bad.
Invested.
Give me your definition.
You left out sexual chemistry. Sorry.
I left out sexual chemistry because
I'm
you
sorry.
Could, because you could love someone without having sexual chemistry.
But don't you? Isn't that?
I mean, you love, you know, you love children. You love.
Oh,
you love,
right, okay. right. I thought we were talking about romantic.
No,
passion.
No. I was just talking about love.
Oh.
Oh, you're talking about love, like the way you can love your pets?
Or sex. I mean, the bottom line is that some of your clients...
You're talking about agape.
So here's a question. So this way I can answer Betsy's question.
Okay.
Did you have any clients who you actually loved, not in love, but loved, who you didn't have sexual chemistry, but you still loved them?
Oh, of course, all the time. I mean, don't you fall in love maybe 10 times a day sometimes?
I live in that place. No, because I love my clients. I love my life. I love, you know, if I didn't like something, I wouldn't do it.
Well, that's you know, that's lucky. That's great. I mean, and I think that most people don't live their lives that way. I think most people go to jobs that they have to go to because that's their job. I don't think that a lot of people don't live that way. That's wonderful that you do. That's an ideal that I would like to strive for. I love teaching and writing, and I just want to spend all of my time doing those two things. And part of it is just that I'm like 250 years old and stripper.
How old are you right now?
42.
In stripper age, you're obviously a lot older, but I'm assuming that you still, you know, look quite well. How much?
I'm a vampire.
You're a vampire. Good.
Yeah, I soak in baby's blood. That's how I'm.
Now I know more about your religion, but let's go move on. the money. Is the money addiction part of the sex addiction?
Absolutely. There's no high like $1,100 in 5 hours.
Okay, so it's interesting. So the way I see you balancing it out is you could. How much would you make a night?
It's like a gambler. It's a gamble. You never know. I mean, a lot of times I walk into work and I think, you know, tonight could be the night where I walk out with nothing. And that doesn't happen. I've gotten really lucky because I'm sort of an expert at what I do.
Well, I think you're an expert in actually creating intimacy. I mean, I could see lots of guys just wanting to talk to you, do nothing else and tip you better than the ones you're giving lap dances to.
They do. Yeah. They like to talk to me. I'm interested in people. I like people. It's stories that I love, and it's people's stories that I am invested in. And I like drawing people out of themselves and getting them to talk.
So if you made the kind of money that you make as a stripper, if you made the kind of money doing the other work, which you thoroughly enjoy, would you still strip?
No.
Interesting.
Absolutely not. No. And you asked me what love is, and you know, I'm still learning what it is. But I like Steve Allman's quote that it's sustained attention ending in eventual mercy. And sexual chemistry is important to me as well. You know, just be interesting. Just be interesting.
But if you, just to backtrack for a minute, if you could make the same money on Wall Street or in medicine or law, would you do this?
Well, it's what I know, Betsy.
Yeah.
I laugh about it because I should have sold cars or homes. Like I would have been really great at it. I could sell an Eskimo ice.
It sounds to me like you could still sell an Eskimo ice.
That's what dancers tell me.
Yeah. I mean, so meaning for
I
you,
could sell, I could sell a person's dentures back to them.
So let me say this to you. Okay. The truth of the matter is you really do have a choice. When you say that's all I know, the bottom line is life is the exchange of emotions. And you are an expert at creating and manipulating emotions. You could leave where you're leaving and get any sales job in any kind of company that you really liked and probably make more money than you make now.
Yeah, but I don't want to sell stuff.
Sweetheart, when you're stripping, you're selling stuff.
What am I selling?
You're selling your personality. You're selling parts of your...
But I don't think I'm selling my personality. I think I'm just... I'm performing.
No, sure, you're not selling it. You're just displaying it.
I think I'm performing intrigue.
Do you ever date any of your clients?
Have I ever dated any of my clients?
If you have to think about it, the answer is you did.
Well, you know, it's funny because I always prided myself in never, ever doing that. And then in New Orleans, a guy who became a very, very close friend, he's basically like, if I were a guy, he would be like the guy, he's the guy version of me, covered in tattoos, you know, triathlete, really ambitious, really funny, really sober. And he became a dear, dear friend. And yeah, I dated him briefly. So yeah, there is one and he's in New Orleans.
And you're still close friends.
Still my best friend, yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah, and he's in a polyamorous relationship, and I play with him and his girlfriend sometimes.
Why do men seek prostitutes, just as a general question?
Because we are dying of loneliness in this culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they seek to connect.
That, by the way, is the brilliant answer, because that's absolutely true. I used to work with a lot of prostitutes and run groups for them. And most of the time, what they would tell me is the men simply wanted to talk.
Yeah. And Betsy, prostitutes, a lot of them are really interesting, remarkable people, and they're fun to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
And they are living a life that's intriguing. And sometimes they just want to tell somebody their secrets. I have so many men's secrets inside of me. Yeah. They just want to talk.
That's what you say. Mm-hmm. My husband's patients say we pay them to go away.
Absolutely.
And the allure is anonymity, as you point out.
Anonymity is the allure for both of us, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Just curious.
Relationships are hard, Betsy.
Yeah.
They're completely different. They're very, very hard. Could you ever see yourself being, now Betsy is she doesn't know this, but maybe she does. She is one of the most committed romantic you will ever find in your entire life.
I've been told that I'm a romantic. Cy Safransky said that I'm a very romantic girl.
Well, that's why I'm going to take issue with that word relationship that you keep using. I wonder if relationship is the proper word for what goes on between you and your sex clients.
Well, you know, no one gets to decide what love is for us.
And
right?
Is it a fantasy that they love you, or do they? What's going on there?
Well, Betsy, you have to ask the question, is love a fantasy?
Oh.
Is love a fantasy? Is it a series of is it serotonin?
Well, and the reason why I ask this is that a person could say, you know, I love my father more than anything in the world. But the day that father crosses the line and does something, whether it's sexually inappropriate or just inappropriate to someone else they love, they take this person who they committed their love to, and all of a sudden they're not in love.
Right.
No, I'm not saying love isn't nine-tenths imagination, because it is. But at the same time, it seems to me that there is a gulf between what you're doing and a really romantic, committed, hot relationship. Am I wrong?
No, there are a lot of differences. I think that, people are moment junkies. And I think that what that means is that when they, and we're talking about a really particular environment, we're talking about in the context of the sex industry. And I'm thinking particularly about, hand job parlors. I worked in a high-end Jack Shack for a while, and that's really particular. It's almost like,
Hold it. There's another, that's another .com. I'm going to buy it. Say it again.
Highendjackshack.com.
Girl, you are in the wrong business. You can make a lot of money just with coming up with these lines.
I'm giving them a Hollywood handshake.
I love it. Yeah, I can see your future right now. It's going to be writing, and it's going to be teaching.
I think empathy, to answer your question, Betsy, I think that delivering genuine empathy, because, I'm sober a long time, so I'm not, like, checking out or drunk or, carrying on with these men, but just because I don't feel, it doesn't sit right with me. Other women do, carry on with customers, meet them for dinner. I don't drink wine. Why? I've been offered a lot of money I've been offered thousands of dollars just to go have sushi with guys. And why? That's totally boring to me. I like to work for my money, and I don't want to feel beholden to someone unless I want to. And so that it just seems boring to me. But what I do like is empathy, and I like stories, and I can kind of hold them in that space.
Though I have to tell you something. I wanted to look at it a different way.
Look at it a different way. Help me out.
I'm going to tell you how I would look at it. The guy who's asking you to have sushi with him is either one or two of personality types. The first is someone who wants to feel that they're just not a client, that you really like them, they're really special. And the other guy just wants to get laid.
Right.
But the person who wants to feel like he is so special, you break the rules just for him.
Yeah.
So to some degree, that could be a turning point in his entire life in terms of his own belief system. The guy who's just looking to get laid, well, he's just not being honest about it. But do you ever run into the number one guy I described?
Of course, all the time. They all want you to break the rules for them. But also, I think there's always like, what's behind that? Behind that is they're also kind of turned on by a woman who just says no. You can't buy me. You can't buy me for an hour. You can't buy me for 3 hours. You can't buy me for the rest of my life. But I'll sit with you right here and we can talk and you can pay me. Sustained attention ending in about $1,100.
But you say one of the reasons you strip is to avoid rejection from men. Is that part of the equation here?
Sure. Of course. Rejection hurts. And risking real rejection in a real actual relationship that's outside of the club. When you're walking around in your underwear and high heels, you're not going to experience a lot of rejection.
Okay, so I'm gonna throw something in. I don't think rejection hurts. I think the only rejection that exists is self-rejection.
What is it called?
So if a blind person came up to you, they came into the strip club totally blind and said, you know what? You have one of the worst bodies in the world and you get hurt. What's the problem?
Yeah, the problem would be me.
No, the problem is you gave them something they never had. You gave them sight. They never had it.
Oh.
Okay. Every single person's experience of rejection is all not what happens to them. It's what they tell themselves within their own head. So the question is, why do you allow anyone to fuck with your head that you will change your own internal dialogue because someone is projecting something on you?
It's an ongoing challenge, isn't it?
It's an ongoing challenge. I want you to kind of work on it. I want you to not give a damn what people think and just enjoy the fact that you love love and you love experience, but I don't want you to be manipulated.
I think this is very deep-seated, though. I mean, when you were a child, almost the first praise you got from your mother was for being sexy. And mm-hmm. this overemphasis on beauty, ergo bulimia, for the Lord's sake, which is extremely hard to break. So I think you were led into objectifying yourself way, way, way too young for this to be easily cast off.
Yeah, I think you're right. So how can I do that?
This is where this is where we're going to break the addiction and get you into a college classroom in an MFA course where you teach some of this very tight, good, honest, brave writing that you have done.
And or you could call me and set up a session and I'll fix you.
And
that's what I really love. You know, the biggest gift in the world was teaching at UCSD last quarter. It was the most exhilarating professional experience of my life by far.
Yeah, there you go.
I loved it.
Yeah. And you know, you've sort of aged out of what you've done. And now is the time to take all those selling skills. And believe me, that's all teaching is. It's being a wonderful salesperson, a seductress, really.
Actually, right, I agree with you, Betsy. I think teaching is stripping.
It is.
Okay? Because what you're doing is you still create the anonymity. You control the environment. You create the emotional dynamic. So we now are coining another thing on Gluck Radio that teaching is the new stripping.
Teaching is the new stripping. You know, you can teach naked writing and you really teach people how to write naked, you know, write their emotion.
Exactly.
Vulnerability on the page.
Yep.
You know, and it's true. It's segue is something that I'm really challenged with, is segueing from stripping and being a performer on that level to, you know, breaking into teaching in California. You guys, it's so competitive. It's rough out there. It's rough out there.
I know. I'm a writer, so I know what you're talking about.
And the content of my book, I'm not sure. I hope that the content of my book helps and doesn't hurt my teaching career.
Well, it's going to help. It's not going to hurt. And we're going to let everyone we know, and we have a nice large audience, to buy your book and to enjoy it because you are so fucking refreshing.
Thank you so much. How did you guys find me?
I just looked up, you know, perfectperson.com, and there you were.
It's been so much fun and so engaging and intelligent. You guys are really wonderful. Thank you so much.
We have to cut it now, but you were absolutely wonderful and delightful. And maybe another time we'll have a part two, okay?
Absolutely. I can't wait to hear from you guys again.
Thanks for being on the show.
Betsy.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. You were wonderful.
Thanks.
It was a pleasure. Thanks, guys.
West us. Bye.
I want to once again thank Antonia Crane for appearing on our show. Pick up a copy of her book, Spent, on Amazon.com. And while you're doing, while you're at it, visit our website, AntoniaCrane.com. So, Betsy, it seemed as if there was a lot of emotion going on in this, and you really had a lot of feelings about it. And I did also. I mean, I kind of saw her as a person who's truly been affected by her past, and yet in every sense of the word, trying to create a way out that was genuine for her, and just she had an incredibly curious mind. Yes, there was a lot of conflict, but I left with a sense of admiration and respect for her.
I disagree. I saw her as a person with so many opportunities. I mean, she does have choice, and this was a really difficult read for me. Really, really hard to descend to the depths of these titty bars and hand jobs and horrible men with pimples on their back. It was a very, very, very hard read, and it reminded me of these salacious 19th century books written by Puritans to steer women away from the streets. So I don't know.
See, I took it exactly the opposite. I see a person who's trying to find her true identity, was fearless and reckless, but yet had the ability to walk into AA and be straight, which means this girl has a tremendous amount of self-control, and she doesn't seem like she has a bitter bone in her body. I got to say it again. I was fascinated by her and loved the conflict that she was still working out and genuinely trying to work out. At the same time, she seems to be having fun. I do think that when she was doing drugs, her life was just falling apart.
I disagree. I don't see her as a happy person now. I mean, in the end, she admits she's looking for love. She's looking for commitment. She's looking for a passionate relationship. And she's looking for a job that will take her out of this work that's caused her not so much fun. I didn't get the fun part the way you did.
And the reason I did is because this girl is so talented, she could, in fact, she knows that she could step into just about any job and make it happen. She could sell ice to the Eskimos. Why she is still struggling, why she is not falling in love, because she doesn't sound like it's hard to fall in love with her, is a question she hasn't answered yet.
No. Well, you have to admire her for being honest about that. I mean, it would be easy to fudge it at the end and come up with a Disney ending.
Yeah, well, nevertheless, I thought that she did not filter her words, and everything that came out of her mouth she actually believed and was quite candid, and I appreciated that.
Yeah, but to me it was still a sordid saga.
And there we have the two sides discussing it. I am Dr. Errol Gluck. Betsy and I both want you to remember, to every problem there is a solution. Please check out Betsy Prelow's books on the art of seduction on Amazon.com. They're entitled Seductress and Swoon, which is now, by the way, in paperback, and that tells you something about the book. When it makes paperback, it means people love it, and so will you. Keep listening, and while you're at it, go to all your friends on Facebook and Twitter and get them to listen to our show. There is something for everyone. What are you doing? Till next time.